The U.S. Supreme Court upholds an important decision in a case concerning access to abortions. Closely watched across the Lone Star State. More today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Amid a pandemic, the start of early voting statewide in primary runoff elections, what's been called a dry run for November. Also, a second look at a string of police shootings in Houston that predate the killing of George Floyd, and what this could mean for the future of police transparency. And Texas researchers develop a sensor to distinguish between symptoms of the flu and COVID-19. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 29th day of June, 2020. I'm David Brown. Hope your Monday's going well so far. A big day in the Lone Star State as Texas gets its first modern test of voting amid a pandemic. Poll workers in face masks will welcome early voters in primary runoff starting today, what the Texas Tribune calls a dry run for November. There are more than 30 runoffs in primary elections for congressional, legislative, and local offices, with what many consider to be the biggest prize going to the Democrat who gets to challenge John Cornyn for his Senate seat this fall. We'll have more on early voting in just a few minutes, but first some breaking news on a legal case closely watched in Texas and nationwide, this one involving reproductive rights decided today by the Supreme Court at issue. A Louisiana law requiring doctors who perform abortions in Louisiana to have hospital admitting privileges. Sound familiar? Well, it's a law that was almost word for word identical to the Texas admitting privileges law at issue in Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt decided in 2016. Joining us to discuss this case and its outcome, Lynn Rambo. She is professor emerita of law at Texas A&M University and a Supreme Court expert. Professor, good to have you join us again on The Standard.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here.
So this case is titled June Medical Services versus Russo, and it's out of Louisiana, but it's especially of note here, as I was saying, because it's very similar, the law at issue, very similar to a state law that the Supreme Court struck down 4 years back, Texas law. Today, the Supreme Court struck down Louisiana's abortion law, too. Why did the Supreme Court take up this case in the first place, having decided Whole Woman's Health just 4 years ago?
Well, the Supreme Court doesn't ever reveal exactly why it's taking cases, but it only takes four members of the court to grant certiorari. So I have a sense that there are four members of the court that are very anxious to act on the Supreme Court's abortion precedent. And you see that in the dissents filed in the case today. So I suspect that it was taken up just as part of that vigorous effort to get abortion cases in front of the court to render them more restrictive.
I want to get back to the 5-4 vote ultimately striking down the Louisiana law. But earlier this year, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer told abortion rights demonstrators, he was talking about the court's two new Trump appointees. He said, "You have unleashed the whirlwind and you will pay the price. You won't know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions." And he was referring to the fact that the Supreme Court was going to be considering this very case. Do you think that warning somehow resonated with the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it's quite possible that it entrenched in the court a sense that it needed to remain independent and that it wasn't going to respond to political threats or the political winds. And it bolsters Chief Justice Roberts' status or his position or role as protecting the court's legitimacy. And I agreed with him that those threats are inappropriate.
Let's talk a little bit about Roberts' role in deciding this case. The vote to strike down Louisiana's law, as I said, was 5-4, but Roberts concurred in the judgment, but not the rationale. So it's not even binding precedent here. What's at issue here, and why couldn't Roberts bring himself to sign on to the opinion of the four justices in the majority?
Well, the four justices who wrote the plurality opinion, and
plurality.
When you say it's not binding, I want to make clear for non-lawyer audiences that the outcome in the case is binding. What that
right.
means is that the wording in the case is not binding precedent. And the four justices in the plurality feel that whole women's health entitles them to look, you know, to scrutinize the state's stated objectives in passing the law. You know, is it really necessary to have admitting privileges for these doctors? Are they really serving an interest, or is that pretext? Chief Justice Roberts is less comfortable with that, and he feels as though the precedent calls not for that weighing test, but basically only asking whether or not a substantial obstacle is placed, and that should be the only test that's applied. So there's a real difference of opinion between Roberts and the four plurality justices as to what the appropriate test for these cases should be.
And that's important because it's conceivable that a slightly different law restricting abortion access could nonetheless be passed in the future and upheld by the court depending on where Roberts is.
That's exactly right, because a different law is going to present a different obstacle to women who are seeking to exercise their right. And so he could easily fall on the other side of the fence if he didn't find a particular obstacle was substantial.
So I want to make sure that listeners understand what the net effect of this case is. The bottom line, it seems to me, is that nothing changes with abortion access as a result of today's decision, but there's an asterisk here.
That's exactly right. I mean, there is still an opening for different laws restricting abortion to be evaluated differently by Chief Justice Roberts, and that's who it's going to be. There's not much question about that. Mm-hmm. It does have a tendency to keep the right intact. I mean, one of the things I want to note is that there's only one mention anywhere in the opinion of someone willing to overturn Roe. Now, admittedly, the parties here were not asking for that.
Right.
So I want to make that clear.
Right. But
only one of the justices telegraphs that he wants to do that, and that's Justice Thomas.
Forgive me for interrupting. We're out of time. Lynn Rambo is Professor Emerita of Law at Texas A&M University, a Supreme Court expert. Thanks so much for speaking with us on The Standard. Now, earlier we mentioned that today's the start of early voting. You'll have until July 10th to vote early. Last chance to cast a ballot for the primary runoff, July 14th. There are specific safety precautions that are largely left up to local officials. And the question is, as a practical matter, how is this going to play out at the polls? Chris Hollins is clerk for Harris County. Welcome to The Texas Standard.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So how is the city and the county, how are the city and the county holding up juggling both COVID and preparing for and executing these early voting polling sites?
Well, as you know, we're facing a second run of COVID-19 here in Harris County and across Texas. Because of that, we are having to do everything in our power to ensure the safety of voters and poll workers if they're going to vote in person. Of course, we're strongly encouraging those who are eligible to vote by mail. You're able to do that if you're 65 years of age or older, if you're traveling outside of your county, if you happen to be confined in jail but you're otherwise eligible to vote, or if you're disabled. And covered under that category of disabled are pregnant women, as well as anyone who has a likelihood of injury to their health by voting in person. The Texas Supreme Court has stated that a lack of immunity to COVID-19 can be considered in your evaluation of your health. However, it cannot be the only factor. And so if you're perfectly healthy, you don't qualify. However, if you have some condition that would further increase a likelihood of injury to your health by voting in person, then you do mm-hmm. qualify to vote by mail.
Have you had to curb the number of polling sites in Harris County, and what precautions are the people who are working the polls actually taking?
So, in fact, we've increased the number of polling sites to 57 for the early vote period. We want people to be able to distance as much as possible, and so having more places to vote makes that a reality. And, of course, we're wanting to increase access for all residents and voters of Harris County. Now, what happens? What can you expect when you get to the polls as a voter? Mm-hmm. Well, first mm-hmm. of all, we're going to be enforcing social distancing. So you'll see bright X's on the ground that mark out 6 feet. And as you enter the polling site, all of the machines will be 6 or more feet apart. When you get to the door, you'll notice the opportunity to vote curbside. And there will also be a hand sanitizing station that you can use. If you come without a mask, we'll offer you one free of charge. We're also going to give you a sanitation wipe that you can use to wipe down your machine, and a finger cover that you can use so that you can operate the machine without physically touching it. The poll workers will all be wearing masks and face shields. And as you're checking in, you'll be separated from the poll worker by plexiglass. And so this is above and beyond what the Secretary of State is recommending. Again, we're doing everything in our power to provide our polling sites and you, the voters, with the resources that you need in order to vote safely.
Primary balloting is typically very low in Texas. That's certainly true for runoffs in primaries. And you have the county sending out an alert asking people to stay home because of the spread of coronavirus. Are you concerned about turnout and how you encourage people to cast a ballot at a time like this?
We are concerned. Normally, you're seeing in an election like this well below 10% turnout. And with fears of coronavirus, that could be even lower. Now, we're doing a couple of things. You know, one, we're encouraging people and letting them know all of these great things that we're doing to protect their safety. But we're also preparing for much higher turnout than expected so that we don't run into a situation where we're running out of masks or running out of gloves, hand sanitizer. And so we are over prepared when it comes to safety. We are encouraging people again to vote by mail if you're eligible. If not, the second safest way to vote is to vote early. I just came from West Gray, which tends to be the biggest precinct for voting in Harris County. You know, there were 10 people there and we have, you know, 25 machines set up. And so just making sure that people know that they can get in and get out as quickly as possible, but especially during early vote, you can go and vote with little to no line.
Chris Hollins is a Harris County clerk. Chris, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks again so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Wells Dunbar is monitoring the talk of Texas on this Monday. Hello, Wells.
Hello, David. We're hearing from our friends and listeners about this morning's abortion-related decision from the Supreme Court. On the Texas Standard Facebook page, Helen Anders applauds the decision, writing, "Thank goodness the precedent was set." That precedent, of course, striking down that nearly identical law in Texas requiring hospital admitting privileges for abortion providers. And via Twitter, Timmy Figgs questions the motivation of Louisiana working to get this case in front of the Supremes to begin with, noting they made the law hoping the high court would overrule its own previous decision. Lots of attention as well via social media trained on John Roberts' role as the deciding vote in that 5-4 vote this morning, David. And following up on the day's other big news, hearing from plenty of people about the launch of early voting. I'll have those reactions later in the show.
Yes, we'd love to hear from you, Texas. What do you make of what's in the news right now? We'd love to hear from you at Texas Standard. Just look for us on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar, back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Weeks before George Floyd was killed in Minnesota, his former hometown Houston saw a deadly streak of police shootings. Since Floyd's death, those Houston cases have received renewed attention, and the city has a new task force to consider some changes. Houston Public Media's Florian Martin looks into whether the current movement might help prevent future shootings and perhaps improve police transparency.
On April 21st, police were called out to Houston's Denver Harbor neighborhood. A man appeared to try to get hit by cars. When they arrived, police say Nicholas Chavez attacked them with a piece of rebar. They tried to subdue him with tasers and beanbag rounds to no effect. In the end, Chavez died in a barrage of gunfire by five different officers.
It was a firing squad.
Jose Hernandez was a friend of Chavez's.
He was in no condition to be a threat to anybody. After you've been shot four times, six really with the non-lethal rounds.
In 5 weeks this spring, Houston police officers shot and killed six people. That's more than in the entire year 2017. The shootings were covered by local TV news.
30-year-old Rayshard Scales.
Adrian Medeiros was shot and killed.
38-year-old Randy Lewis.
Also Christopher Aguirre and one man whose name has not been published. Chavez's death is among the most controversial because eyewitness video shows him kneeling on the ground when officers shot him. Police say they had to because Chavez got control of a taser. Joe Gamaldi is the president of the Houston Police Officers Union.
We don't allow suspects to taser police officers. Okay, a taser can still be used as a deadly weapon that could easily take out an officer's eye, or that could easily incapacitate that officer with the improper reaction that his body could have to it.
Gamaldi calls it a suicide by cop. Hernandez says his friend had been depressed, but wasn't suicidal. And even if he was, Hernandez says, the cop should have helped him. Thousands have marched since George Floyd was killed in police custody in Minneapolis. But in Houston, people still want answers. Isidro Garza is with the Greater Houston Coalition for Justice. They've rallied for body camera and dash cam footage.
I think it would behoove the chief to release those as soon as possible so that the community would have that. Because maybe there's information in those videos that would exonerate the officers.
Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo has received national praise for marching with George Floyd's protesters. But many have called him hypocritical because he hasn't released footage of the shootings by his own officers. Instead, the chief held a press conference where some family members explained why they want to keep the videos private.
I only have two priorities right now.
Audric Miniaris' brother was killed during a traffic stop.
Two priorities. That's to protect my family and protect my brother's name. And that's what I want to do right now, by not letting the video to be released.
But some police say body camera footage can clear things up for everyone. Here's the union's Joe Gamaldi again.
For these shootings, I believe that they are all 100% justified, and that if they want to release body camera with family's permission, I'm in favor of them viewing the body camera video.
Some see releasing these videos as just a start to police reform. At Floyd's funeral, Mayor Sylvester Turner announced a new executive order. It prohibits chokeholds, requires de-escalation, and to exhaust all non-lethal options. But it's an empty gesture for Ashton Woods, founder of Black Lives Matter Houston.
I would refer to Eric Garner and George Floyd also, because in those two cities before they were even murdered at the hands of police, there were already rules that govern that you cannot use chokeholds.
Woods, for one, thinks there will only be change when the current system of policing is radically reformed and more effort is put into improving communities of color. I'm Florian Martin in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. A couple of weeks ago here on The Standard, we told you about the drop-off in liquefied natural gas exports coming out of the U.S., LNG. Well, that's leading to an ever-growing glut of the stuff that's showing no signs of ending anytime soon. And though LNG prices have sure taken a beating, that could be good news for some consumers here in Texas. Here with more energy insider Matt Smith, he's director of commodity research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you very much, David.
Temperatures going up across the Lone Star State. How are dropping gas prices going to help out consumers?
Well, as you mentioned, in terms of that, those LNG exports getting crushed, there's been like 45 cargoes being cancelled for July. That's about a half of all exports. And some 100 cargoes are said to be cancelled over the June to August timeframe. Mm-hmm. And so that's essentially gas that's going to stay in the U.S. rather than being exported. And it's essentially because the world is oversupplied with natural gas. Specifically in the U.S., we're oversupplied because of industrial demand being down as a result of the coronavirus. And so that, combined with a mild winter and a mild spring, has led to storage building up. And it's now a third higher than where it was this time last year, and it's continuing to rise. Prices are rebounding today, but late last week, as you mentioned, they've dropped to a 25-year low of $1.40 in MMBTU.
Just to be clear, when we're talking about natural gas, that's an input when it comes to the production of electricity. So for those people who are planning on cranking up the AC, those lower natural gas prices could mean cheaper energy.
Yeah, that's the key takeaway here for your listeners. ERCOT, who is the body for power in Texas, ERCOT power prices are remaining very low despite record high power burn demand expected for the upcoming summer, simply because of these low natural gas prices. Natural gas makes up the most significant share of the ERCOT power generation stack. So, for example, so far this month, natural gas accounts for about 47% of that total generation mix, which is far higher than it has been for the rest of this year, which has been about under 43%. So that's why it's so key. It's the biggest piece of the pie, and it's also extremely cheap at the moment.
What could happen next for natural gas prices? Because although this is good for consumers, there's been a real push, especially along the Texas Gulf Coast and further along the Gulf Coast, to try to increase exports. And now we have this glut of LNG.
Yeah. So the lowest ever price for natural gas was $1.05 back in 1992, so, 28 years ago. And prices could continue to drift lower towards that level if we have a number of different factors. If we see a mild summer, we know that these LNG cancellations are baked in the cake. We know that they are coming. But if we do see ongoing coronavirus lockdowns, we could see storage approaching its limits, and so we could get back to that price, a 28-year low.
Wow. A good amount of natural gas production is from oil production, of course.
Right.
How's that looking for Texas now?
Oil prices, David, they're now close to $40 a barrel, and so production is likely being restarted at that level. There was a Dallas Fed survey last week that said the majority of respondents said that an oil price above $35 a barrel was enough to restart wells. And so oil production is getting restarted here. And because of the associated gas that comes from oil production, natural gas production should be increasing in Texas too.
Oh boy, just adding to the glut is what it sounds like. This is an ongoing story, one that Matt Smith continues to track as Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, thanks for the update.
Thank you, David.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. Governor Greg Abbott and Vice President Mike Pence are urging Texans to wear face masks as the state confronts an ongoing surge in COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations. During a news conference Sunday, Abbott said the outbreak has taken a dangerous turn in Texas in recent weeks. He highlighted the positivity rate, which is the ratio of positive cases to the number of tests conducted.
And the positivity rate that just 1 month ago was at 4.27%. is now well over 13%.
Vice President Mike Pence, who joined Abbott after speaking at a Dallas megachurch, said people should comply with local orders requiring face masks.
We encourage everyone to wear a mask in the affected areas. And where you can't maintain social distancing, wearing a mask is just a good idea.
While Governor Abbott has refrained from issuing a statewide order requiring people to wear face coverings, a new directive he issued Friday required bars to close and restaurants to reduce dining capacity from 75 to 50%. Also over the weekend, Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins sent Abbott a letter asking him to take additional steps amid the pandemic, including requiring all Texans to wear face masks and physically distance. A U.S. representative from Texas is hoping Republicans and Democrats can reach a compromise to pass legislation overhauling policing as both parties' proposals stall in Congress. Houston Democrat Al Green told WFAA on Sunday the Democratic bill in the U.S. House approved last week is much stronger than the Republican one in the Senate.
Much of what they were proposing was going to exist in a world where incentives would be used to get things done. There are some things that I think you cannot incentivize. When it comes to things associated with knees on necks and these body cameras being off when they should be on, the whole notion that we can cajole people into doing this is not something I think we should approach. It's time to mandate. The House bill mandates, the Senate bill did not.
Unlike the GOP bill, the Democrats' George Floyd Justice in Policing Act bans federal police from using chokeholds and no-knock warrants in drug-related cases. Houston native Megan Thee Stallion last night took home BET's award for Best Female Hip Hop Artist.
I used to watch the BET Awards all the time thinking one day that's going to be me going up there and accepting my awards. And that is. So thank y'all so much. And hotties, I'm going to just keep going hard for y'all.
Megan Thee Stallion accepted the award and shared her thanks virtually since the in-person ceremony was canceled due to the pandemic. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the law firm of Barron, Adler, Clough, and Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas, protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It's been over 3 months since the pandemic hit in the U.S., and even though we are still in it, we've been thinking about what recovery will mean in terms of the economy. Today, we're getting some help from labor economist Marie Mora. She is a former UTRGV professor in economics who now teaches economics at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. Professor Mora, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I want to ask you about what you've said about the recovery, that one way to protect more Texans from the next downturn is to move as many workers currently in blue-collar jobs into white-collar jobs. Could you explain your thinking behind that?
Oh, yes. So one of the concerns that we've seen with our COVID-19 environment is that when we talked about transitioning our work to our home, most of the jobs that we're able to do so were predominantly white collar. And if we think about ways to move forward in terms of protecting our workforce from future types of pandemics, we would need to find more creative ways to open up opportunities for workers to be able to transition to home if needed.
Professor, I think some listening, though, will say, but that doesn't mean that you won't still have a need for those blue collar jobs to be filled, for people to do those important tasks. What would you say? I mean, is this about moving people more into a white-collar economy, or is it about providing greater protections for the blue-collar economy?
I actually think, to a large extent, it's a combination of the two, because as you rightly point out, there are some positions that we just can't transition to home, regardless of the skill level that's required of them. Certainly more training and more protection for those workers would go a long way. This means working very closely with local government officials, also public health officials, and to keep track of what's happening on the ground with respect to the spread of viruses.
What we are hearing quite a bit from leaders in higher education is that this is as much a tough time for them as it is perhaps a moment of opportunity, an opportunity to reimagine higher education. Do you agree, and how might that fit into the Texas economy at large?
Yes, I actually do agree with that. One of the things that we've been talking about at my institution, University of Missouri St. Louis, is thinking about some of our certificate programs. Right now, there's a big concern about providing more workforce development opportunities. So in short term, institutions can think about ways that they can provide courses, maybe short programs, where adult learners can acquire not only the learning and skills, but also, let's say, certificates or credentials. But over time, to think about how those could fit into a larger degree program so that as workers are picking up the certificates, they're still making progress toward an actual degree. I think this is also an opportunity for institutions of higher education to work closely with industry to find out from industry leaders what they need their workforce to understand and learn. And there may be ways that institutions can provide tailored certificates that would meet the industry demand.
It's hard to imagine recovery without considering our biggest trading partner, which is Mexico. Is this an opportunity to reimagine international trade with Mexico? And if so, what should be done to change the status quo?
Actually, I'm really glad that you asked that question. I think that that is something that people outside of the state may not be as aware of it, about the interdependence that Texas and Mexico have. The city of McAllen, for example, one-third of its retail sales tax revenue comes from Mexican shoppers, the cross-border shoppers. And so that's been a concern when we think about the effects of COVID-19 on all the stay-at-home orders. Closing of the border, that's restricting a lot of the movement of people and goods that we tend to see between Texas and Mexico. Many people are familiar with Mexicans coming into the U.S., but in addition, there is a non-trivial number of Americans who live on the U.S. side of the border, but they actually work in Mexico. So we have cross-border labor markets as well as cross-border markets for goods and services. And border crossing times also play a big role in terms of when we think about cross-border trade. If people anticipate long border waiting times, they'll be less likely to cross the border. So we need to find creative ways to facilitate, you know, the flow of traffic. I don't know if it would be opening up additional bridges, having more. I know that they have some of the border crossing lanes where they have the little automated passes where people don't have to actually stop, that they're approved for a much faster entry into either country. And I could see perhaps with trading and more information in terms of what's happening with the coronavirus on both sides of the border, that there could be some kind of program where people could register their, their health conditions before crossing so that they could also have that facilitation to go back and forth.
Taking advantage of technological innovations.
Correct.
Dr. Marie Mora teaches economics at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. She's a labor economist. Professor, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Right. Thank you very much for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town with tours of Moody Mansion, Bryan Museum, and Bishop's Palace. More at galveston.com. It's island time. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
My name's Jer Confrey. I am a grandmother who moved to Austin in the last 6 months to be near my adult children and their four grandkids. I am retiring as a professor from North Carolina State University, where I worked in mathematics education. When the pandemic started, it became clear that my husband and I both needed to isolate for our age. So it was very difficult because all of a sudden we were sidelined in terms of being able to help to care for the grandkids. It was a definite shock for everybody to go from seeing them so often to not being able to give them hugs. And what inspired the book was in particular when one of them looked at me and looked and said, "But Grandma, I'm not sick." And I realized that they were really confused about why we were in this situation. So I wrote this book called Love Without Hugs. Its primary purpose is to reassure kids that the kind of distancing we have to do, that it's not their fault, that we still love them, and that pandemics do end. It was also written to try to explain to them the idea of a carrier. And I did that through an analogy to the way that a dog carries burrs and doesn't know it. But if an owner pets the dog, they'll feel the burrs, and so that the kids can begin to understand why they can be carriers even without being sick. Yes, it's difficult for kids to understand the idea that they have to stay away from their grandparents, especially when they're close to them. But we have developed a highly developed ability to do air hugs. They actually come over and visit. We live in a cove and they stay outside. We all stay outside in the cove and we stay behind the barrier so that we can still watch what they do. We have also gone to such lengths as delivering them baked goods using a fishing pole so that they can see some humor in all of this, as well as sitting in the back of our Ford truck and our chairs and having meals with them, and that way keeping at a distance from them. Love Without Hugs is available in both Kindle and in paperback form. I also just want to say that we are giving part of the proceeds to buying personal protective equipment for healthcare providers. Both my grown children here are doctors, and we really feel that it's essential that we get enough equipment to our healthcare providers. My name is Jer Confrey. I am the author of the book Love Without Hugs, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Hey Experts have long predicted a so-called second wave of the coronavirus could hit in the fall. That's especially concerning because if that happens, it would coincide with a regular flu season. There's been some misinformation about COVID-19 and what we just know as the flu. The viruses both spread through contact and droplets and both cause respiratory disease, too. The big difference, of course, is the severity. While we're still learning a lot about COVID-19, we do know it's much more deadly. So fast forward to, say, October. You begin coughing and feeling sick. Is it the flu or COVID-19? Well, knowing the difference fast could affect your treatment. UT Austin Electrical and Computer Engineering postdoctoral fellow Dimitri Kariv is part of a team working on just that. Dimitri, thanks for your time.
Yes, thank you, David, for inviting here. It's great to be here.
What exactly is it that you are developing? I understand a sensor of some sort?
Yes, that's correct. So what myself and my supervisor, Professor Akin Wande, we decided to build an electrical biosensor that can detect both or either COVID-19 and influenza in a very fast, simple, but very precise way.
What is that way and where does this sensor go and that sort of thing?
So, I mean, it will be sort of a hard sensor, but imagine like a point of care sensor that you can buy maybe in Walgreens, and you just use your saliva sample to provide the bioanalytes to the sensor. And then we utilize graphene. So graphene is a sensing element of the chip. So the graphene is very sensitive to literally everything, but then we infuse the graphene with antibodies. And those antibodies are specific to COVID-19, and there are other antibodies that are specific to influenza. Mm-hmm. And they're specific, like imagine like a key and lock kind of attachment. So like it is only specific to COVID. So then we can have, okay, it is we hit specifically COVID virus.
So you would have to have some kind of conduction differential, I guess. When you think about shortages of other equipment, especially during this pandemic, and you think of testing capacity, for example, what are your options? Are some more attractive than others?
Well, that's a big question, I guess, and also the shortage of medical personnel, right? So like all the mm-hmm. the numbers of tests that will have to be run are doubling, tripling, and probably tenfolding every day. And the sample, the tests these days take hours and sometimes even up to days to perform. And what we imagine to make is our sensor will be, I mean, it will be a disposable one. It won't be a reusable one, but it can give you a result within a minute or two.
Maybe you can explain this a bit further. Why is it important that your sensor would need to test for both the coronavirus and the flu?
Imagine it is winter. Imagine if you got symptoms, like, and you don't know if is it flu or is it COVID. Do you self-isolate yourself for 14 days? Do you go to work? What do you do? So we believe like a sensor such can, you can purchase in Walgreens, for example. You can have it at home. You develop a symptoms. And you just simply do a test and you say, okay, well, it's just flu. It's okay. I don't have to send mm-hmm. all my people away. Or you're like, oh, damn it, it's COVID-19. Okay, I have to self-isolate. I have to be very careful to the society.
I would imagine you must feel a certain sense of urgency to get this done quickly.
I mean, it's obviously, I mean, we want to provide the device to society as fast as possible, urgency to make the devices as fast as possible. And actually, I mean, I'm in the lab right now, so we are working as much as in our power to make it work as fast as possible.
Wow. So what would be the soonest estimated time of arrival? Could it be ready by the fall?
Well, we hope it to be ready by the fall, maybe the winter, so the fall to winter beginning of the season. So it is tough to predict when exactly it will be ready, but we are optimistic that it should be done by the end of the year.
UT Austin Electrical and Computer Engineering postdoctoral fellow Dimitri Kariv is part of a team working on developing a sensor which could test for both COVID-19 and the regular flu. Dimitri, thanks very much, and we'll let you get back to work.
Thank you very much, David. Have a good day.
Dallas hairstylist Shelley Luther got national attention for her defiance of coronavirus lockdown restrictions. A new survey, however, shows most of her fellow stylists disagree with her stance. The University of Houston study found 57% of hairstylists surveyed disapproved of Luther's decision. Even so, more than 90% said they had no choice but to return to work for economic reasons. Also, with early voting and primary runoffs beginning today, we're profiling some of the contestants in closely watched races all week. That undertaking gets underway in earnest next, as The Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose fight against cancer includes telemedicine. At home, virtual visits with doctors help patients keep appointments while continuing to practice safe social distancing. Learn more at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at TexasCollegeSavings.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. His supporters believe it just may be Royce West's moment. The longtime Texas state senator is asking for a promotion to the U.S. Senate, and with police reform on people's minds in Texas and across the nation, West's record on that issue could help him win votes in the Democratic primary runoff on July 14th. KERA's Brett Jaspers has this profile.
Years ago, when his kids were young, Royce West remembers getting stopped by a cop.
So I was taking my son to get a baseball glove or something like that, and my sons were in the car with me. And so the police officer came up and said that I had rolled through the stop sign. Okay, and of course, I said I didn't do that.
He kept his cool. When the officer went to check his computer, West turned to the boys.
I said, this is a good lesson for you. You know, you can't win it out on the street. Don't even try, because that officer has the power of life and death. And I'd rather for you to come home, and then we can win it in the court.
West has spent his career in court as a lawyer, including stints as a defense attorney and a prosecutor. He's also logged decades in another hall of power, the Texas legislature. He seems to believe deeply that a strong, respectful argument will bring you a long way. Dallas County's chief prosecutor, John Cruzo, has known West for over 40 years. He says West doesn't let policy clashes get personal.
I've seen him with some pretty hardcore right-wing folks. And he maintains a cordial relationship. He'll kind of poke them in the ribs about their positions, but laughingly so. They'll poke him back. They get along.
As a state senator representing the southern part of Dallas County, West has focused on education and won funding for families who take in their relatives as foster children. But with the nation roiling over the death of George Floyd, politicians are hearing calls for police reform. West has worked on that, too, like a notable 2001 Texas law banning racial profiling in policing and putting dashboard cameras in cop cars.
We did the hard work. We stayed long hours to make certain we're able to hash out compromises as related to the language in the bill.
It was a huge fuss when he did it because the police didn't want him.
State Senator John Whitmire of Houston chairs the Criminal Justice Committee. Getting the dash cam law passed, Whitmire says, is just one example of West's talent for reasoning with opponents.
He had these skills to explain that it was going to be beneficial for all policemen, particularly the good police officers. It would give them a narrative of what they did and why they did it, and not to mention it would expose bad police officers.
Many years after that dash cam bill, the state passed a law on body-worn cameras. West authored that one, too, and calls it a success. But critics say the law doesn't do enough to increase police accountability. Rather, it more often protects police. That's because the law made it way too hard for the public to access the tapes, according to criminal justice reform advocate Scott Henson.
His body cam bill made the body cams much more closed than the dash cam footage had been.
Henson runs the Texas nonprofit Just Liberty and founded the criminal justice blog Grits for Breakfast. He thinks West has done some good things on policing too, like the earlier racial profiling law, but he calls the senator's record on criminal justice reform a mixed bag. Henson does, however, see West as a pragmatist and thinks the killing of George Floyd has dramatically shifted what people want.
The terms of debate have changed. The earth has moved under our feet, and that's as true for him as it is everybody else. And I expect that he will see more opportunities going forward because of that, and I hope he takes them.
So what does West want to accomplish in Washington, D.C. if he beats fellow Democrat MJ Hagar and then Republican John Cornyn? In an interview, West said he wants a national standard for when officers can use deadly force and to condition criminal justice funding on it.
There should be one law governing the use of deadly force in this country.
West doesn't want to defund police departments, but thinks cities should look at their budgets and possibly reallocate money to other services, like mental health. West said this moment calls for more than study and small tweaks.
I don't want to sell us short. I want to see restructuring in this society where people in poverty, most of which are people of color, get a better shake. And we don't keep on talking about it over and over and over again.
In 2021, Royce West will either be Texas's junior U.S. senator in an era of peak polarization or back in the Texas Senate debating police reform at a pivotal moment. Either way, he'll need full use of his powers of persuasion. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Here to tell us what Texans are talking about on social media, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello there, Wells.
Howdy, David. Hearing from folks about today being the first day of early voting in this expanded two-week period for the Texas runoff elections. Lots of folks sounding off with some opinions, not too happy, honestly, about the fact that they still have to go out to vote in the midst of this pandemic. Tim Bauer-Kemper on our Facebook page. He writes, "My parents haven't been anywhere since the first week of March, and both have complications that mean that COVID-19 would be death. They're eligible for mail-in, but wouldn't have been just a few years ago when those health complications would have been just as deadly." Meanwhile, Amy Alvey Stanley, she says, "I'm not thrilled about it, but I'm going to do it." She says, adds that she's honestly more concerned about the election workers who have to be around so many people. Good point there indeed. Robin Richter, on a similar note, she says that, "I've been a poll worker and I won't vote in person." She has that option as she is over 65 and can vote by mail. But she says, "I don't see how they can make it safe, particularly for the workers." Darlene Luna, she closes things out by recommending some common sense guidelines here, just to wear a mask, social distance, keep clean hands, and use other common sense notions to prevent the spread of coronavirus. But obviously, lots of people are very concerned about the early voting here in person. Although, hopefully, yes, that expanded early voting period should help with the crowds there, as we heard earlier in the show.
Yeah, you know, state officials are saying bring your own hand sanitizer and your own face mask, of course. Another thing, of course, you're going to have the social distancing, and it's going to make lines look longer than they normally would be during a primary runoff. So don't let that put you off. If you're going to be casting a ballot this go round, the lines, yeah, they'll look longer, but they'll move along, and that's what election officials are saying.
You know, obviously, COVID-19, the big story. Looking around here on Twitter, seeing an article or some breaking news that's trending. Gilead Sciences, one of these drug manufacturers, coming out with its pricing plans for its COVID-19 drug. Let's see, I believe it's Remdesivir. Believe that a course of treatment, this is a drug that's administered several times, a five-day course of treatment expected to cost private health insurers over $3,000 and Medicaid providers, government companies, over $2,000, this for a five-day treatment of their patented coronavirus drug. So obviously, as you might imagine, folks sounding off on that story, one of the many stories that we're continuing to watch, David.
You can keep up with all the news 24/7 over at texasstandard.org. Alas, we're out of time for the broadcast. But we're going to be back here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us then. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard team, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.